Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on school closures in Griffith. A multi-million dollar cleanup is underway on the Lake George Canal. Attorney General Curtis Hill has filed a lawsuit against the owners of Purdue Pharma. Jill Sheridan and Carter Barrett report on student mental health. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Scott Pilath of the Kankakee River Basin Committee. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says a $26 million cleanup will begin this month of contamination on the Lake George Canal in northwest Indiana. The EPA says sediment will be dredged in Hammond and East Chicago. Work is expected to be completed in 2020. The canal flows into Lake Michigan and is part of the Grand Calumet River Area of Concern, which has been identified by the U.S. and Canada as a Great Lakes Basin toxic hotspot. The East Chicago Waterway Management District, Atlantic Richfield Company, and BP Products North America are involved in the cleanup. The river flows 13 miles through Gary, East Chicago, and Hammond. Steelmaking, meatpacking, and oil refining contaminated the river's sediment with heavy metals and PCBs, as well as oil and grease.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Between 7 and 10 teacher positions in Griffith Public Schools were eliminated this week in a move the district superintendent attributes to declining enrollment and an expected deficit next school year. Four classified staff positions were also cut last week. News of the staff reductions spread early this week. Around the same time, remaining teachers in the district learned of their class schedules for the 2019-2020 school year. Superintendent Michelle Rice says affected teachers were informed of the staff reductions in person last week. All teachers were notified in person by the end of the day, Friday. Cuts affect all levels in the Griffith District. Superintendent Rice said, as word of the reduction spread on social media, so did the rumors about changes in the district. Some expressed fears that classes such as yearbook, AP chemistry, or robotics would be cut. Rice said in an email sent to staff and later to parents Tuesday evening that extracurricular programs are not being cut. She said courses in the arts and foreign language departments may be consolidated based on shrinking class size due to declining enrollment. According to Rice, the district lost 76 students between September 2018 and February 2019. In a state funding model where dollars follow students, Griffith's student enrollment losses last year cost the district $532,000. Between its high school, middle school, and three elementaries, the district enrolled 2,336 students in February. Griffith Public Schools also expect to lose $800,000 in public funding. The Griffith School Board closed enrollment to students from outside the district in 2018, shortly before Rice began as superintendent. The Times reports the superintendent said the board has no intentions to consider reopening enrollment as the community was generally supportive of the decision to close enrollment in the schools. Reductions in the Griffith District came following news Tuesday night that Hammond will close three schools and eliminate between 130 and 150 positions district-wide as this school year draws to a close. Lake Ridge Schools made a similar announcement last month, sharing plans to close one of its schools and eliminate more than 20 positions after the district's failed November referendum. Some affected employees in the Griffith Public Schools were offered positions elsewhere in the district. In total, the school system is Griffith's largest employer with 312 total staff. Superintendent says, "We wanted to help notify in a timely fashion." She goes on to say it's a decision she doesn't take lightly.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Cameras will be installed at the Porter County Animal Shelter in an effort to prevent pets from being abandoned after hours. The installation of an outdoor camera was approved Tuesday by the county commissioners. More than $10,000 worth of camera equipment will be installed for general security purposes and to prevent dumping after the county found certain people leaving animals outside the shelter after hours. Darren Briggs, the shelter's assistant director, said the last incident occurred in the summer 2018 when a short-haired cat was left in a box in the morning. The Times reports Commissioner Laura Blaney said the deterrent was worthwhile to protect animals, the shelter staff, and the public. Six cameras will be installed, five inside and one over the parking lot. Blaney stressed that no one has been hurt, but it has happened enough that the county had been discussing installing cameras for a while. The shelter is open from noon to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Friday and noon to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. It is closed on Monday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Despite an initial request Wednesday by the defense for a trial date, a judge scheduled a June status hearing for a former Geary school superintendent charged with stealing from the cash-strapped district. Cheryl Pruitt appeared with attorney Scott King for a brief hearing before late criminal court judge Diane Boswell. King initially asked Boswell to schedule a 2 to 3 day trial. Boswell asked King and Lake County Deputy Prosecutor Judith Massa to approach the bench. After a private discussion, the attorneys agreed to a status hearing June 11th. The Times reports Pruitt was charged October 5th in Lake County Criminal Court with felony counts of theft and official misconduct, which alleged she deposited a $1,200 reimbursement from the district into her personal bank account after the district already paid $1,600 from its extracurricular account to a district credit card to pay for her business trip in May 2016. The state took over the Geary Community School Corp in 2017, delegating all authority of the school board and superintendent to an emergency manager who could cut costs and pay off more than $100 million in debt. In mid-October 2018, the State Board of Accounts released results of a special investigation audit and asked Pruitt to repay nearly $7,200 to the district for inappropriate spending of taxpayer dollars. The Indiana Attorney General's office filed a civil lawsuit against Pruitt on November 28th. In that lawsuit, the state's is seeking more than $18,000 in penalties and fines. Pruitt is accused of wrongfully receiving or diverting funds from the district. Lake Superior Court Judge William Davis stayed any discovery against Pruitt in the civil lawsuit until June 26. That case is set for a February 1, 2020 jury trial.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Attorney General Curtis Hill filed a lawsuit Tuesday against members of the Sackler family, alleging that as owners and directors of Purdue Pharma, the Sacklers have played a key role in worsening the opioid crisis in Indiana. Purdue Pharma is best known for making and marketing the painkiller OxyContin. In November of 2018, Attorney General Hill filed a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma alleging the company intentionally understated the health risks of long-term opioid use and deceptively marketed several drugs in ways that violated Indiana law. That matter remains pending in Marion Superior Court. In Tuesday's lawsuit, the state of Indiana alleges that members of the Sackler family directed, approved of, and participated in their company's destructive strategies. The lawsuit further alleges that the Sacklers enriched themselves to the tune of billions of dollars from these schemes. In fact, the Sacklers instructed Purdue Pharma to distribute approximately $4.3 billion to the Sackler family from April 2008 until 2016 alone. The lawsuit alleges that these members of the Sackler family, who individually served as Purdue Pharma's CEO, vice president, and or board directors, violated the Deceptive Consumer Sales Act, the Prescription Drug Discount and Benefit Card Statute, the False Claims Act, and the Medicaid False Claims Act, among other unlawful activities. Attorney General Hill said, "We believe the Sacklers' wrongful acts have left a wake of addiction, death, and devastation in Indiana and across the country." The lawsuit seeks civil penalties, treble damages, disgorgement of ill-gotten gains, and restitution of sums constituting unjust enrichment. The Office of the Attorney General intends to continue working to ensure that any funds becoming available through this action would be used to help address the public health crisis brought on by Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family's misconduct.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hundreds rallied at the State House Tuesday as part of a coordinated effort to protest anti-abortion laws nationwide. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the rallies are a response to recent legislation in states like Alabama and Georgia, some of the most restrictive and punitive anti-abortion measures in decades.
Simone Bailey says the need for the rallies is not just about other states. Bailey was a college student in Indiana when she had an abortion, and she told the crowd she never paid much attention to reproductive rights issues before that.
Especially here in Indiana, it's really disturbing what they are saying about people like me and people like all of you who feel like it's my right and it's your right to decide what you want to do with your body.
Speakers at the rally urged the crowd to get involved, to vote, and to contact elected officials, as Raven Ragel did when she gave out Governor Eric Holcomb's office number.
You call him, and you call him, and you call him until he gets it, because it seems like he doesn't.
Holcomb has signed into law 4 anti-abortion measures since he took office. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
When the private evangelical Taylor University announced Vice President and former Indiana Governor Mike Pence would give the commencement speech this past weekend, the backlash was almost immediate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Bagiano spent commencement day on campus gathering varying opinions about the Vice President's visit.
Dana Cotum traveled from California to watch her daughter graduate with a degree in social work. She says while her daughter told her it was surprising to her that the vice president would give the commencement address, Cotum didn't think too much about it because she didn't realize the vice president's connections to the state.
No sabíamos que él iba a venir.
I guess he used to be governor in the state. I don't know anything about that. Cotum is Latina. She says she understands Pence is controversial because he's Donald Trump's vice president and the administration's treatment of immigrants. But she says she was there to support her daughter and felt the vice president's presence didn't affect her. If anything, I'm excited to see him. But one Hoosier, Michael Feit, felt the need to protest from across the street. For hours, he held a hard-to-miss rainbow pride flag in silence. He says he has LGBTQ+ family and hasn't forgotten Pence's tenure as Indiana governor and stance on LGBTQ+ rights. In 2006, then-Indiana Congressman Pence was one of more than 100 sponsors to support the Marriage Protection Amendment, which aimed to define marriage solely between a man and a woman.
What would you say to the vice president, you know, if you could talk to him right now?
You can't put that on air. I'm being honest. I have no filter.
Thank you so much. President Haynes, Board of Trustees, faculty, staff, family, distinguished guests, it is an honor for us to be here at the Kessler Center for the commencement ceremony of the Taylor University Class of 2019. Congratulations. You made it.
The vice president's visit to his home state garnered a lot of media attention, not because he was delivering a commencement address, but because of where. Students and faculty were able to peacefully protest the vice president's commencement address by walking out before he began. But student David Musselman says this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and should be embraced as such.
I'm sure people will remember this for the rest of their lives. I couldn't even remember who spoke at my brother's graduation 3 years ago. And I'll remember this the rest of my life.
Musselman started the I Like Mike campaign on campus a few weeks back in response to the backlash against the vice president.
My name is Christine Newman Ahmiller. I'm a Taylor grad, and I'm protesting because Taylor stands for people with a servant's heart. And Mike Pence does not have a servant's heart, and I don't believe he is deserving of speaking at Taylor University.
Newman Ahmiller and her sister, Marilyn Dodds, are both Taylor alumni. Their father also worked for the university. They both say they were disappointed Taylor chose Pence to deliver the commencement address because they say he doesn't represent the service-driven mission at the core of the school's curriculum. Newman Ahmiller says it's tradition for Taylor graduates to receive a servant's towel along with their diplomas. The towels allude to Jesus Christ washing the feet of his disciples.
Giving Mike Pence a servant's towel does not reflect how he acts.
Vice President Mike Pence will also deliver the commencement address at the West Point Military Academy in New York on Saturday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Rural America has high rates of chronic disease. The more remote a community, the more heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And there's a side effect many people don't think about: depression, anxiety, even suicide. This is especially true for older adults. Side Effects Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports from Casey County, Kentucky, 2 hours south of Louisville.
There's a long one-story house that comes up quick, right after a pretty big curve in the road. There I meet
Dennis Pond, P-O-N-D, like a fishing pond.
He asks me to pardon the mess. He and his wife, Gay, collect things, like a pizza cutter in the shape of a bicycle, an antique fishing reel, old photos. I'm here to talk with Dennis about his chronic health problems. In 2006, he was in the hospital because of a bad case of pneumonia, and
the doctor asked me, he said, Mr. Pond, he said, how long have you been a diabetic? And I didn't know I was a diabetic, so.
Oh, really?
So I could have been a diabetic for most of my life and didn't know it.
Now he has severe nerve damage in his feet. And Gay says Dennis's doctor
said he's a prime candidate for to have his feet taken off.
Yeah.
Amputation is a sign that diabetes hasn't been well controlled. It's almost always preventable. And it's a result of blood supply slowly being cut off, what he describes as 1,000 needles on the bottom of his feet.
The pain gets so bad sometimes that I actually feel like either cutting my own feet off or just taking care of myself, if you know what I mean by that. I mean, ending it.
Mental illness and thoughts of suicide are hidden issues for many people with chronic disease. It doesn't get talked about a lot, but emerging research shows it's a big problem. In a follow-up call, Dennis confirms that this whole situation with his diabetes, along with blood clots and a bad back, it makes him depressed. Just a few years ago, he was involuntarily committed to a state mental hospital after trying to kill himself.
Well, I think when a person has a lot of pain in their life, you know, it causes them to go into depression.
Yeah.
And it makes them feel suicidal because they feel like they're useless. So they want to just, you know, do away with it.
Yeah. That's what some people call deaths of despair.
These are kind of mortality causes that are associated with hopelessness.
Michael Meat heads the NORC Center for Rural Health Analysis in Chicago. He says these are deaths from a drug overdose or related to alcohol or by suicide. Suicide rates in 2017 were 30% higher in Appalachia than the rest of the country. And within the region, suicides were concentrated in
so eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, eastern Tennessee.
Meat says it's not a coincidence that these areas have high rates of chronic disease. Other factors also play in, like the loss of jobs. Gina Piani was one of the first researchers to start putting two and two together. She's a professor at National University in California. In 2014, she published a study on people with chronic conditions and their feelings.
As you have more chronic conditions, you also are more likely to report psychological distress. And those are correlated with depression and with suicide ideation as well.
Piani says the answer is preventing these diseases by giving young people more health and nutrition education. Psychologist John Fulton has another solution for the people he sees at an outpatient clinic about 30 miles from Pond's house. He tries to teach people coping skills.
And I try to say, you know, you're sitting there focusing on the bad things, and all that's going to do is drag you down deeper. And try to get them to turn around and start thinking about, well, I'll go outside and look at dogs, or I'll watch wrestling on TV or something.
Dennis does have a good support system in his wife. He and Gay married in 2013 after he did work on her house.
The first kiss was like a little pick. And I said, no, that ain't the way to do it. Let me show you how to do it.
Well, that's the first date.
And so we started going together. She's my wife and she's my friend.
And there might be hope for Dennis's pain. He's likely going to get surgery that would increase blood flow in his feet. I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After two school shootings last year, lawmakers named mental health services in schools a top priority. Many schools across the state say they need more counselors and therapists. Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Carter Barrett and health reporter Jill Sheridan partnered to report on current mental health services and the aims to provide more. Barrett brings us part one of this two-part series, a look at a program state policymakers point to as an example.
Hamilton Southeastern Schools established its mental health initiative within a larger local response to suicide. In 2015, Fisher's Mayor Scott Fadness launched a community-wide conversation.
I could tell you right off the top of my head that we'd only had three homicides in 20 years, but in that particular year, 14 people had taken their own life.
A part of the district's effort was founding a club to help high school students manage stress. At the beginning of the spring semester, two dozen students gather after class in a large open auditorium. Relaxation stations ring the room. Yoga, mindfulness, adult coloring.
We want to start off the new year right with healthy coping habits and like ways to relieve stress.
Senior Sam Houston says the club works to reduce the stigma around mental health.
So our thought is that if we can create an environment, not only in our club meetings, but in our school, where we accept mental illness and it kind of becomes, talking about our mental illness is something that becomes normal.
In 2016, the affluent suburb north of Indianapolis passed a $17 million referenda. Some of these funds supported a partnership with a mental health care provider. The district also received grant funding for this work. This partnership means community health network therapists are embedded in nearly every district school. If a parent consents to the treatment, students receive counseling as they would in a doctor's office, but they're in school. Then the parent's insurance is billed for the service. The referenda funds cover additional costs, including the coordination of services between therapists and school officials. Here's the district's mental health coordinator, Brooke Lawson.
Really nice to have that coordination of service. The therapist can talk with the teachers, they can talk with the principals, the school counselors, and just really have some open communication about the behaviors that are going on and also the supports and the strategies that they're trying to teach the child. They can help the school reinforce that.
Last year, 600 Hamilton Southeastern students received mental health therapy through this program. School data shows an increase in GPA and a decrease in discipline problems among students who received treatment. There hasn't been a youth suicide in the district since 2013. And the Fishers community has seen improved outcomes as well. Mayor Fadness says the key is combining forces, police, fire department, healthcare providers, and schools, to tackle the issue from all sides.
We were able to get everybody to the table, point everybody in the same direction, and then hold each other accountable towards an outcome.
Can this be duplicated? After two school shootings in Indiana last year, lawmakers called mental health treatment in schools a top priority.
Senator Kreider to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the Senate. I think in my seven sessions here, this is the most frustrating bill that I've worked on.
During the most recent legislative session, Republican Senator Michael Kreider authored several bills to establish grants to connect students with treatment.
Because I feel like it's a bit unfair to expect school counselors to also be mental health providers to understand the mechanisms of mental illness.
This bill became law. It does help parents pay for mental health treatment, but it does not give schools money to start mental health programs like Hamilton Southeastern has done. So I asked Fisher's Mayor Scott Fadness.
How achievable do you think this work is in other communities?
People ask that all the time, particularly in the context of Indiana, because when I go around, they're like, well, you're Fishers, you have all this money, and you can do this. You know, for the first 2 years of our work, we didn't spend any money. We just were getting together trying to figure out how to solve this problem. And in reality, a lot of the things that you can fix don't cost any money.
He acknowledges every community will face different challenges.
But I think everyone in Indiana could be doing a better job.
And similar programs don't always have the same outcomes. In the next part of this series, an Indianapolis school uses the same method as Hamilton Southeastern schools, but faces different challenges. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's school leaders say mental health is a priority. And now we have part two in our series on mental health services in Indiana schools, reported by Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan and Carter Barrett. Sheridan brings us the second installment. It examines one school that implemented mental health services but still struggles to care for students exposed to poverty, drug addiction, and gun violence.
After two school shootings in Indiana last year, Republican Senator Mike Kreider proposed a bill to provide care for more students. He didn't find the support he hoped for.
Well, it's a subject most people are uncomfortable with, and it's frankly one of those that, unless your family is directly impacted, you don't realize how really important this type of bill is.
His bill set up a limited amount of money to help parents cover students' mental health services. CEO of a mental health consulting group, Suzanne Clifford, says lawmakers need to do more to help children succeed.
There's numerous studies demonstrating that if we don't treat mental health conditions, we have very poor educational outcomes. It is the largest group of children that are not graduating high school. It is the leading cause of disability of children.
Barriers exist for many school districts. They include lack of leadership, consistent funding, and stigma. Fishers, Indiana School District, addresses its barriers with significant help from the community. We profiled that effort in part one. Hamilton Southeastern Schools partner with mental health care providers to bring services to students within schools. Other districts do this too. This lively classroom is at George S. Buck, an elementary school on Indianapolis's far east side. Very good. This book is blank. Across the hallway, a food bank stocked with canned fruits, body wash, and soups. Like the Fishers District that is held up as an example by policymakers, this school in Indianapolis Public Schools IPS District contracts with a local hospital network. But they say they need more to care for students at risk of poverty, substance abuse, and gun violence. Principal Dr. Tanika Holden Flynn says some students in the zip code have a lot on their mind when they come to school.
We definitely have students who experience things at home, right, in terms of domestic violence, abuse, right? But even if you are a student who, you know, you don't have that home life and things are going pretty well, because of the neighborhood, there are things that you're going to be exposed to, you know, murders, robberies.
A therapist at George S. Buck has a caseload of approximately 30 students who receive mental health care at school. Around one-third of these students have previously been in foster care, and nearly all services are billed through Medicaid. A majority of IPS schools also have a social worker. Yvonne Hollins has worked at George S. Buck for 6 years, knocking on doors and talking with parents about treatment and reinforcing it. She says it can be a challenge, in part because of stigma.
And they don't want people in their business. We live in private, but we can't get help in private.
Holland says families may struggle with medical bills and lack of social support. Some have more basic needs.
I will deliver food. Also, transportation is a huge issue for a lot of our families. They don't have cars. And the bus system, while we sit in a neighborhood, there's not a bus stop right here.
Indianapolis Public Schools did receive grant funding to increase social-emotional learning. But Hollins and Principal Holden Flynn say they need more to offer comprehensive care in less obvious ways, like reducing class size and teacher assistance. Brent Freeman oversees mental health in the IPS district and says they also struggle for community buy-in.
A big challenge for us would just be getting all of the stakeholders to the table. And so I know one of the things that we've been looking up in Fishers, right, in Hamilton Southeastern is just their involvement with the mayor's office and EMS and their police department.
Without strong state and local support, many schools try and cobble together mental health programs through referenda and grants. One option that would have created those type of grants fell short in the state legislature. While it does provide a limited pot of money to support individual children, it does not create state funding for districts to set up, sustain, or increase mental health services in schools. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Dunes National Park is celebrating its new designation by marking the occasion with a renaming ceremony and an exhibit at the Indiana Welcome Center. Park Superintendent Paul Labovitz spoke to Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about the upcoming events.
A lot of very exciting things happening at Indiana Dunes National Park, being that it's now a national park. And I know that you're marking the occasion with several notable celebrations. You're having a renaming ceremony, or is that still, that's coming up, right?
It's coming up on Tuesday. The governor, Congressman Pete Pasglowski, and our two U.S. senators, Senator Young and Senator Braun, are going to help unveil a sign with our new name.
And the National Park is celebrating the redesignation with an indoor exhibit, 61. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority there on Indianapolis Boulevard in Lake County have graciously allowed us to work with their team to put an exhibit in their exhibit hall. I think it's over 6,000 square feet of exhibit space of the variety of things you can experience here at Indiana Dunes National Park.
So what's going to go into the exhibit, and what are the things that are going to be highlighted?
You know, you try to do a little bit of everything that you can see and do here. So there are exhibits about our trails, there are exhibits about the lakes, there's exhibit about plants and animals. I saw a picture of a truck bringing sand into the exhibit hall. Some of our cultural resources like the Bailey Homestead and the Century of Progress Homes. You know, a little bit of everything, which, is what the national park here is all about.
That's quite a list. I mean, could people get all of those attractions done in one day?
Well, you'll be able to do it at the South Shore CVA's Visitor Center because the exhibit's going to be a teaser. No, you could not do all those things in one day. And that's the point of just to let people know that, especially for folks who live close to here, that this is the kind of place that you want to keep coming back to and experiencing a different part of the park, whether it's the great beaches on Lake Michigan or a real special place like Pinhook Bog that is further away from the lake, but a pretty spectacular collection of bog, plants, and just beautiful scenery.
So give us the Cliff Notes version. This has been a long time coming. How did Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore become Indiana Dunes National Park?
It's a story that's about 103 years old. When the National Park system was first established in 1916, the first director was a Chicago businessman named Stephen Mather. And he had proposed an idea back in 1916 to create what he had called Indiana Sand Dunes National Park. And, you know, World War I was underway. The state of Indiana decided to do some industrial development, and the conservation community spent an additional 50 years trying to put the political support together to create a national park here. So in 1966, as part of the deal that created the Port of Indiana, the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore was established. And then, you know, for 53 years, the park as a lakeshore delivered great public experiences. And the beginning of this year, in early mid-February, the Indiana Congressional delegation was able to get the name changed to National Park. And it's been a bit of a rebirth, even though the change doesn't change the budget or the regulatory authorities of the park. But the recognition of that name is perceived internationally to be special. And so people are coming here and visiting the new national park from all over the place, really. It's been fun.
Are you already seeing an increase in visitors?
We are. I don't have numbers, but I know anecdotally from our visitor centers, people are coming in to get their national park passport stamp that says Indiana Dunes National Park. A lot of people, when they visit a national park site, and there are 419 national park sites, will get a stamp that's similar in style but with the name and the date of the visit of the park they're at, and they collect them. And so we, for years, had the National Lakeshore stamp, and now we have a national park stamp.
So it's the attractions at the national park that's the stamp, because there's 61 national parks. You said 419 of 419 attractions?
Well, there are 419 national park sites in the national park system. 61 of those, and this is where the 61 exhibit comes into play, are named national parks. Some are national lakeshores, national rivers, national battlefields, national seashores, national monuments. There's over 20-some different names of national park sites. They all have passports, stamps.
Because the place is the same, so what's the difference really?
Well, I kid people. I tell people that our signs are cheaper because there's less letters in them.
Cheaper printing, definitely.
Yeah, cheaper production for signs. No, nothing has changed but the name. But as I mentioned, perceptually, people think of the title National Park as really being something extra special. We're quick to tell people that all those 419 national park sites are extra special. But, you know, you got to play to the market, and when the market wants to talk about just the 61 national parks, it's really nice to be on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we are, and we hope to benefit not just as a park, but as a region and all the other businesses and attractions that serve our residents and our visitors, and that this increase will be a good thing for us all.
I was just going to ask you about that. How do you think it's going to affect the area, the surrounding area, Northwest Indiana, economically?
Well, see, I tell people that the park, both the Indiana Dunes National Park and state parks, are the number one tourist attraction in Indiana, and through a variety of economic studies, seem to be responsible for upwards of $500 million of economic activity in the region per year. And so, you know, we're part of the complex equation of what makes this a great place to live, work, and play. And those of us who live here know that. And when visitors come here, whatever their impression is of Northwest Indiana, having never been here, they leave somewhat blown away about how wonderful it is.
Where do people come from to visit the national park and what obviously was once Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore? Do they come from everywhere in the world?
Yeah, I mean, a large percentage of our visitors come from the region, South, you know, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois. But literally, there are people from all over the country and the world who come here throughout the year. Our visitor center has a little map that shows where people are from, and they're literally from all over the world.
Is there any way you can elaborate a little bit more on how economically Northwest Indiana will benefit from this designation?
Well, yeah, obviously the number of people who come here and visit and spend money on lodging and food and entertainment is an obvious benefit. But for the people who live here, at some point, the value of private property that's near the park tends to increase because there is a park here. And those real estate values, as they increase the generation of taxes for the municipality so that they can do more in their communities. Almost incalculable, I can hardly say that, is that because of this open space here, we produce a lot of clean water and clean air, a place for people to come and relax and refresh. And so what is the economic value of a healthy place like that? It's hard to put a number to it.
Talking with Paul Labovitz, the superintendent of Indiana Dunes National Park. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Sharon. Good to talk with you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Scott Pilath, Executive Director of the new Kankakee River Basin Commission.
We associate, it seems, the Kankakee River and to a little lesser extent, although not much, the Yellow River that runs to the east of Lake County in Porter and other counties with the flooding problems. And Kankakee in particular, there isn't a time that you don't seem to go down U.S. 41 headed to Shelby or to Samava Resorts and points to the south from Lake into Newton County without seeing the river just barely underneath the bridge. And that's because the whole area is, of course, very low. The flooding is common, and in fact, last year it got rather historic in some respect. That is why there are some major changes that state lawmakers realized after last year's flooding that they really needed to do something serious to try to resolve the problem. And that is why our guest here in the studio is talking about his job as the executive director of the commissions to be able to help handle the problem with flooding. Scott Pilath, I guess the short definition of your job is executive director of, I guess, what is going to be the Kankakee River Basin Commission.
Actually, Chris, it will be in statute the Kankakee River Basin and Yellow River Basin Development Commission.
Yeah, it's a very long name. Now, as you have to find a way to pare that down, I know.
That's right. As I mentioned to you off the air, that'll be one of our first duties is to come up with a workable name.
Let's take some time to do a little history lesson here. We probably people have never really known that the problems that have lied upon the Kankakee River in particular that people get to see virtually every day or they live around it go back into the 19th century. In fact, the land was such that basically that I understand that the watershed was the second largest in the country.
That's correct, Chris. And by the way, it's great to be here with you today to talk about this very important topic, but one that has a lot of exciting and compelling changes ahead. The Grand Kankakee Marsh was once the second largest freshwater marsh in the United States. And beginning in the 19th century and ending in World War I, there were massive drainage projects that were undertaken by state government and by the local governments. And the reason was pretty basic. They exposed some of the most productive farmland in the world. You know, and this farmland is now a key part of our economy. It's an important component of our tax base for public services here in this region. And it allowed the development of a number of important and historic communities here in the area. But we're still living with the consequences of it because the underlying topography and geology still has this tendency to create marsh-like effects. So we have to deal with the implications of that because certainly we have many eggs in the economic basket with respect to these long-ago decisions. And then we have the human factors. And then we have the quality of life issues that remain with us as well. So the state legislature has finally taken very substantive steps to try to deal with the implications of these things that are really 100 years in the making.
When the first commissions, I guess, or actually the whatever predated the commissions,
right,
came about here back in the early 20th century after the big dredging project of 1918, that finished up, you say, 1919. Was there anything that was set up at that time that you know of in looking through the history books to try to find some way to come up with a plan to deal with all of these problems that came about from all that that marshland?
Here's what happened. Yeah. You have eight counties that basically comprise the Kankakee River Basin. And I'll rattle them off as I did before. St. Joe, Marshall, LaPorte, Stark, Porter, Jasper, Lake, and Newton.
And that's actually the way it starts, because it starts in South Bend and moves west.
That's how I name them off.
Yeah.
What happened was is that each county would just battle the river on its own. They would do what seemed to make sense from their own parochial perspective. But there was a tragedy of the commons that happened. Every county sort of acted in its own self-interest, and as a result, we wound up with a worse result for everybody. You know, more flooding, more erosion, more difficulties for agriculture and communities. So in the late 1970s, the Kankakee River Basin Commission was formed by the state legislature. And that's where the process of trying to coordinate drainage policies began. You still had local counties paying for their share of it, but there was some forum to try to get everyone to work in concert. To their credit, that commission got us to the present day, and in tandem with Chris, it was a record flood in 2018. It was a record at two gauges. In tandem with the increase in precipitation and major flood events, and the work of the commission previously, it sort of got the state government to the point where they were willing to make long-term investments in our region to deal with these long-standing problems.
Since the flooding, I guess, is when the real serious work on a long-range plan has gotten underway, tell us what the project is like right now, and
sure,
hopefully when will those who will make decisions about this plan will get to see it?
Last year, the state legislature released funds to the Kankakee River Basin Commission and directed that those funds be used to come up with a long-term work plan. And Christopher Burke Engineering was employed to come up with the work plan. It has been presented in draft forms to the commission as it exists now, and we're expecting a draft final report really in another few weeks, mm-hmm, which will then be handed off to the new commission to begin in earnest some of the long-term efforts that are going to need to be undertaken. What this report is going to contain are a couple of key components. One, we have unimaginable amounts of sediment that keep entering the system. The glaciers dump sand in this part of the world. There are sand dunes in Marshall County and in Stark County where the Yellow River originates. There are sand banks up and down the Kankakee. And what happens is there's more water entering the system, as we do have both for natural reasons and for human reasons, the amount of erosion is increasing. So you have all this glacial sediment still clogging up the Yellow River and clogging up the Kankakee, and it shouldn't be any surprise when you add more water to that, you have more flood events and more water going where it's not beneficial to humans. So we have to begin by mitigating sediment, keeping sediment from coming out of the Yellow River. We have to begin by stabilizing our banks along the Kankakee, and we have to begin the process of deciding how we're going to manage the water that's currently there. One final thing, we also have to learn how to work with our neighbors in Illinois to solve this problem as well, because that is where the Kankakee ends up. It's a tributary of the Illinois River. So this commission will also be tasked with partnering with the state of Illinois, so we're working in concert.
When the commission was founded, I know that since you had several counties, all these counties involved in this one way or the other, and these all had to, I guess, get their own way to their own funding, that is, to get this work done that they could do. They got some nominal help, I understand, from the state government, but it never seemed to be enough to be able to do much, was it?
Yeah, and not only was it not enough, and there were some years where, you know, it might be $1 million. There were other years where maybe it was $600,000. When you talk about 122 miles of river, that just doesn't go very far. In addition, is that the commission at the time would never know whether it was going to have funds in the future. So then the natural inclination is to, you know, be very careful with the funds that you're using, do it more for things like pilot projects and studies and maybe things that can help educate the public about solutions going forward. But now there's a commitment to, you know, regional long-term funding. So we have we'll have the capability in the future to make substantial change for longstanding problems.
Now, the measure that the General Assembly passed here this past session not only changes the makeup of the commission itself, but it also adds in that funding issue, and it gives at least the opportunity to have something that is more permanent, it seems, and certainly more reliable, is it not, having this actual assessment procedure?
That's right. As constructed, it will be a long-term funding stream, and it'll be a reliable one. So you can make a plan and then have an idea of how you're going to put that plan into action.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's important to remember, because it'll be funded for assessments on parcels within the basin, is they contribute water to the system. Some of the amounts are rather nominal, about $3.50 a bill for, you know, if you're a residential parcel owner. Working in concert with the Indiana Farm Bureau, an amount was determined to be $1 a farm acre in order to consolidate these resources and be able to do the long-term projects, which will benefit everybody. I think the important thing to remember is that we're paying for it now.
Yeah.
You know, we pay for it in property damage. We pay for it in reduced property values. We pay for it in erosion of the tax base. But what we've done up to this point is pay for problems, and now we have the opportunity to be in paying for solutions, and that's a demarcation.
Was that something that came as, I'm sure, lately at least, was a result of last year's flooding? Was there so much damage, so many people that were affected personally, as well as farmers that had their land affected by the flooding? So it got to actually see personally, and for some people, as I say, firsthand, what the flooding situation has come to these days.
That's correct, and that's where I, you know, just having served with a number of these lawmakers in the past and knowing what their perspective was, they just simply became determined that they needed to do something, that what we were doing by sort of kicking the can down the road and not making commitment to long-term solutions was exacting real costs on the people of the region.
With the procedure now set up and the new commission to be created here in the months ahead, and you say also, too, you get to see the first draft, the final report of the long-range plan that the engineers have been all working on very hard for the last few months, what is going to be the makeup of the new commission? Because we have a commission now that, at least up to this point, is 24 members. It represents three people from every county in the area, and it's going to get pared down to only nine.
It'll be pared down to nine. There'll be one member appointed by the county commission of each county. One facet that I'm excited about, though, is that the ninth member will be either the director of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources or his or her designee.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage there is we know that regulators have a major role in the type of work that needs to be done, and I think there's immense value in having an important regulator, being the DNR, formally involved from the get-go. That way, we know if we're risking running afoul of state, local, and federal rules that were engaged in that process from the very beginning and aren't moving off into directions that aren't going to be fruitful in the long term.
Now, I have to ask, when you have a commission that was so populated with all these people from all the counties, and you have to trim it down from 24 to 9, what's been the reaction here to the changes that are going to come about here to this much smaller commission?
That's an excellent question, Chris. You have people on the current commission who have just poured their hearts and souls into the river and care about it very deeply. I think there is a realization, though, that if there is going to be a commitment to funding, that office is going to bring about governance structure changes. That's not uncommon. That happens frequently. And I think many people ultimately believed and supported the fact that the most important thing to do was the work. And as long as we're doing the work, who's involved from year to year in terms of decision making, that's okay. We can have a. It's about the outcomes. It's about the outcomes.
Any idea when the last big official meeting is going to be of the now existing commission?
That's right. The final meeting of the Kankakee River Basin Commission will be on June 13th. And that's the commission is currently comprised. And we generally meet either in Knox or North Judson because it's a good central location between, you know, cutting across two time zones. But I'm hopeful, and it's my tentative plan, that the new commission will convene sometime in early July. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my task at the moment is to make sure that we have a smooth transition between two different governance structures.
Well, Scott Pilat, thank you for joining us to talk about this. It's a big project, as big as the river basin itself of the Yellow and the Kankakee Rivers, to be sure, and trying to deal with the historic flooding that seems like it's always happened along that part of Lake County and surrounding counties as well, too. So we'll see what happens and how the commission that will be taking over this summer will be doing, and also, too, to find out more about that long-range plan that everybody will have a chance to take a look at and see what can be done to deal with the problems and the benefits that come from living along or in the Kankakee and the Yellow River basins. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Scott Pilat is the executive director of what is for now known as the Kankakee River Basin Commission.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.